The richer you get, the harder it is to manage your estate. There's lots of moving parts like portfolio diversity, tax mitigation, asset protection, and estate planning. That's why the ultra wealthy use family offices, and that's where Volarity Wealth comes in for you. Run by a former sovereign wealth fund manager, Volarity Wealth brings institutional level expertise to the high paid professional. Let Volarity quarterback your finances. Book your free consultation at VolarityWealth.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest is Zulfi Ali. Now, Zulfi is going to be a recurrent guest on the show. We are going to do a weekly episode that is going to be released on Wednesday mornings. And the purpose of this is to do something a little bit different from what the Monday show is. The Monday show, or shall I say Sunday show, depends on when you listen to it, is more of an interview-based show on common topic. Like, for example, last week, Les Rubin was talking about the U.S. debt, things like that. But what Zulfi's going to provide us is a sort of a real-time look at the economy, what's going on, and sort of really help us kind of understand where we are in cycles and that kind of thing. As you may recall, Zulfi is with Volarity Wealth, who we work with closely, and he's got a significant background in finance, having run a sovereign wealth fund in the Middle East, also working for JP Morgan in London, and before that in New York. So obviously it's nice to have his perspective with us. So welcome back to the show, Zulf.
Great to be back, Buck. Thanks for having me.
So last week, well, I should say this week, I interviewed a guy by the name of Les Rubin. Les is a sort of a traditionalist guy. You hear a lot of people with his take in this space about concerns about U.S. debt and entitlements and all that stuff. And obviously, it's serious stuff. But I'm curious on your take on that podcast. What's the deal here? Should we be worried about U.S. debt? Or is that something that really is something that we don't need to worry about right now, and why?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd worry about it, Buck. I think, you know, from a historical perspective, U.S. debt to GDP is high, but, you know, it's not completely out of whack, as you might think, listening to some folks just tossing out numbers and that sort of thing. I think Les did mention that we're currently at about 1.25 times debt to GDP for the amount of government debt that's outstanding. You know, that is, yeah, it's a high number, but, you know, look in the broader global economies, you have countries in Europe like France and Spain that are about, you know, 110, 115%. Canada's over 100%. UK's pretty much at 100%. Japan, one of the highest, is at about 250%. Obviously, their economy has been tough for a couple decades. But it has not rolled over completely. In fact, it's back, seems to be back on track. The Nikkei index is up 34% year over year recently. So, you know, things are going well. So I think just at the face value, looking at, you know, the debt amount that is outstanding from the U.S. government, you know, it gives you a snapshot, but I don't think it gives you a complete picture. And as you, you know, as you kind of discussed it, as you ended that podcast, it's probably not something that we need to be overly concerned about. You know, there's different ways to look at that debt number as well. So of the $34 trillion of debt outstanding, $7 trillion of it is actually intergovernmental debt. So it's just transactions between one part of a government to another part of the same government. Really doesn't have any impact on the government finances. So you can kind of ignore that piece. And so then you're down again to about 100% debt to GDP, which isn't crazy for an economy like ours. And then you take into factor the fact that, you know, as a global currency, the US dollar is, you know, the standard, and the US having its ability to print money when needed, I just think that it has the ability to stretch those those debt figures up quite a bit higher before people would get truly worried about it.
So, you know, well, people listening to this who are listening to all these other shows in this ecosystem where there's a lot of alarms going off about debt and all that may be wondering, well, gosh, you know, I listen to other shows and they're telling me that, you know, the U.S. dollar is about to implode and we're about to become Greece and all that kind of stuff. And I bring that up because, listen, yeah, one of the things that I think for me, too, over the last decade of doing this, I've just realized that there is sort of this there are these different sort of narratives going on. And certainly the narrative that we often get in this podcast ecosystem is that of sort of the, you know, alternative gold bugs and that kind of thing, which is fine. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But I think what your perspective is important because what you're representing is the way that large institutions and governments look at this stuff, because you have literally been managing, you know, you've literally managed the sovereign wealth fund. So when you hear that kind of thing, what is your reaction?
Well, my reaction is that I think that those perspectives are viewing government debt, particularly U.S. government debt, as being pretty much the same as household debt or corporate debt.
Or even Greece.
Or even Greece, which, right, you know, once the euro came, it had no control of currency at all, right? And mm-hmm. It was subject to a rates environment that was, you know, dictated by a central bank that didn't necessarily, reflect the situation, you know, within Greece. It gave Greece a lot of bad incentives to take on a lot of debt. So I think it's a poor comparison. I don't think there's any comparison with respect to what the U.S.'s ability is. Again, having control of the global currency, having the most diversified economy on the globe, having the largest economy on the globe, being considered the safest place to put your cash in the world. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very different, different equation. And again, I think a lot of people will, you know, kind of relate to the debt amounts and the debt ratios with respect to their own households or corporates in their debt levels. And they just don't translate well. At the end of the day, those entities and those households, they can't print their own. They can't print their own currency. It's a pretty stark difference.
And I guess just as a corollary to that, people might say, well, yeah, I mean, but how long can you keep printing your own currency? And I think it's a fair question. You said it's because we're the largest economy and all that, but isn't there a limit to that to a certain degree? Or, you know, is it a matter of us just being the global power and that there's not really anybody in real competition with us, or how is that?
Listen, I think it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, the investors, you know, think of it this way, you know, all that debt has to be bought by investors, right? So to me, rather than looking at these metrics where you're looking at a, you know, a percentage or ratio of debt to GDP or, you know, the interest payments to GDP, which is another, you know, common ratio. What I would focus on is, does the government have the ability to continue to issue its debt, and are investors continuing to buy that debt? I think that's what you want to keep an eye on. So, you know, there is no answer to your question as to, you know, how much is too much, whether it's printing, whether it's debt issuance. We're not going to know that in advance. I think you start to get some hints of it if things start, you know, start showing up in various parts of the market. So, you know, the thing I would look at is Treasury auctions. The U.S., the way it raises debt is through very regular auctions of its securities. So new bonds and notes that it issues are auctioned off at treasuries. And that process, you know, is very indicative of the demand by investors. And so at the end of the day, you know, as long as investors are buying and the prices aren't, you know, aren't going crazy. So, you know, investors aren't expecting some huge premium for the bonds to buy the bonds, then you know that you've got a pretty decent environment. And the key stakeholders, the investors, are not concerned. They right. still view it the safest place to park their money. Right.
So, and those are the other countries, right? I mean, those are the other countries that obviously are looking at us and have confidence in us, in our economy. But
that's right. Roughly a third of U.S. debt is owned by foreign countries like Japan, China, UK, so on.
Is that declining?
It is declining. It peaked, I think, approximately 2010, 2011. Foreign countries owned almost a half of U.S. government debt. That has gone down to where they now own about 30%. There's various theories on why that is. There's been increased buying, for example, by the likes of China, particularly in the last couple of years. China's been a very aggressive buyer of gold. They are, mm-hmm. Are putting a lot of that, exposure over to gold. You know, that could be a factor of maybe there's a little bit of concern that, debt, there's a lot of debt issuances by the U.S., but my guess is it's more to do with geopolitical positioning, right? Why would two potential adversaries be in a situation where one would be dependent on the currency of the other? I think, right. China would like to diversify away from the U.S., would like to be in a position where it isn't as beholden to the currency of the U.S. and potential sanctions by the U.S. and so on and so forth. So I think there's some of that that's going on in the background. Overall, the recent Treasury auctions, it was just a Treasury auction this week that was launched for $125 billion.
What does that mean? Just so people understand so the Treasury auctions, tell us how that works.
Yeah, it's basically the U.S. Government raises its debt by issuing bonds and notes. Uh-huh. Bonds are the longer term, notes are the shorter term, securities. And there's an auction process where the government actually allows investors to set the price. And so it's not the government setting the price, it's the market that sets the price. And those investors say how much or what rate they're willing to accept on the coupons of those bonds. And so that process goes on, on a weekly basis, and is a very regular and important part of a functioning government issuance process. And those numbers that they are auctioning have been getting bigger and bigger. And so, there's been speculation by some, newspapers and pundits about, how much is too much. Is there a point at which, the auctions become too big and, there just won't be appetite for them, or investors will start demanding a much higher premium? Those are things that I think people are watching closely. So far, not much of an impact. Even this week, it looks like, everything is going well and there won't be any unusual situations.
Okay, so let's say, we do know, obviously, let's just take the position that there is this spiraling and unsustainable debt levels by our government. And if that's the case, how do we position our investment portfolios for that risk?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that's the question, Buck. You hit it square on the head. Is, if an investor wants to think about, okay, this may be a small likelihood or a small chance of happening, or maybe some investors think this could be a very, considerable chance that something like this happens. That's something that they should reflect in their investment portfolios. And if you want to kind of think through, if you've got spiraling debt, there's probably a lot of pressure for the government to contain that through potentially, lots of printing currency. So that's, going to instigate some inflation, maybe a lot of inflation. You're going to have a situation where interest rates are probably going to be high because, again, a lot of debt out there and high inflation is going to lead to a situation where you've got high interest rates. You're going to have, you know, a situation where the economy is probably going to have a tougher time with that kind of cost of capital. You know, so you want to think about hedging a little bit or a lot, depending on your perspective and how much you want to, you know, you want to think of this as a likely scenario. But typically real assets do the best in those kinds of situations, right? So they inflate with inflation. You can get real assets, and that can be gold, by the way, that can be real estate, that could even be the aviation fund that we've been talking about to your investors on the aircraft. But assets, hard assets, that will appreciate in an inflationary environment, and particularly those that are leverageable, because in that type of environment, you want to have some debt. I'm not saying go crazy and over-leverage yourself, but have some modest amount of debt, because your assets are going to appreciate, the debt's going to stay the same, and therefore you should come out well there. And then I would say, you know, the tax environment is likely to be, unfriendly as well. Because again, if you assume that the government needs to raise cash, then taxes are probably already being, increased on lots of different corporates and households. And so, you know, looking for investments that generate some tax efficiency. And again, you know, you want to look at things like real estate or the aircraft finance fund, that sort of stuff. So, those are the types of things I would look at if you want to make sure that you've got exposure to assets that are going to do well in that environment.
Yeah, just to reiterate one thing and just a basic concept, when he was talking about leverage, the idea there is that if you have a certain amount of debt, and there's inflation going on, effectively, the amount of money that you owe back will be worth less over a period of time. So just think about that. And that's, again, like he mentioned, it's not something you want to overdo, but it is something to think about, because inflation ultimately awards debtors. So let's finish this out with talking a little bit about the current market trends, the latest Fed outlook. I've been talking a little bit about, you know, lately about how I think there's a good reason to think that interest rates are going to come down. Tell us your perspective.
I'm of the view that interest rates are probably going to stay relatively stable. I think you're going to have a Fed that doesn't have the data to take down the Fed rate anytime in the near term. And near term, I'm talking next 3 to 6 months. I think it's going to be very much data dependent. And I think so far, you know, the Fed has not seen what it has wanted to see. And it's, sure, it's been a little bit, you know, pressured to the other side, particularly, you know, on the wages. They're seeing, you know, employment is still very strong. So I think, you know, I think there's a few different things there that they haven't seen yet, that you know, is going to allow them to take it down. Now, on the flip side, Chairman Powell, you know, last week also said that, you know, they're not likely to hike. So that's a good thing. You know, there was some folks thinking, oh my gosh, we're gonna get back to another hiking, type of situation. But I think the Fed wants to take down rates a couple notches. But they really want to wait, because the last thing they want to do, Buck, is to do it too soon, have inflation start ticking up again, and then have to reverse course and start hiking again. That would be the worst case scenario. So I think they want to get to a place where they're really comfortable that taking down the rates will not lead to further inflation. I think, you know, if you're just looking at where we are today, I think they're very comfortable. They feel like this is a sustainable position. They are being restrictive. They're not, you know, the economy is being held back a slight bit by it, but not too bad. I mean, the recent first quarter earnings all being reported by a lot of companies, and companies are doing pretty well overall, with their earnings.
So what do you think? Do you have any, I mean, obviously you're just going to predict the future, but any longer term interest rate outlooks?
Yeah, I think it will over time. I think towards the end of the year, you're going to start seeing the rates come down. I think the Fed by that point will have seen it. I think the labor markets will cool. I think we've been, you know, we've had a nice start to the year, but I do think things are going to cool. We're hearing about layoffs from various tech companies, and you know, these are like 10,000 people here, 15,000 people there. So that, you know, that starts adding up. And I think that, you know, that's gonna play itself out. And then I think you mentioned as well on one of your recent podcasts that, you know, the rent or the cost of living, you know, measure that they have is a trailing indicator, and that's, you know, that in real time is already down from where it was, and what, you know, how it feeds into the current you know, statistics. So I think we're headed the right direction. It's just gonna take a little bit longer because we don't want to the Fed doesn't want to do something that it has to reverse.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, there is a fair amount of also simultaneously quantitative tightening going on as well, just in the background as well, which we don't talk about much, but all those elements I would think would you know, result in certainly cooling inflation and hopefully seeing rates come down by the end of the year.
Yeah. Let's
talk a little bit before we go. Talk a little bit about Volarity. What are you doing over there? Volarity Wealth. I mean, some people have a number of people who are investors have dealt with Volarity through the broker dealer side in doing some of these private placements. But what is Volarity Wealth? What do you do? What's the purpose?
Yeah, as I think I've told you, Buck, you know, Volarity Wealth, it's a registered investment advisor platform where, you know, I could take all the experience that I got at the Sovereign Wealth Fund, looking at alternative asset classes as well as traditional asset classes, looking at how you can build up portfolios and diversify them to meet the specific needs of individuals. And so that was the thrust behind, you know, Volarity Wealth. We're unique in the RIA space in the sense that we're not just going to take investors and put them into a 60-40 you know, equity and bond portfolio and call it a day and talk to you once a quarter and say, here's what's going on with your portfolio. We're actually at the very front end, you know, very involved in developing an investment strategy and a financial plan for you that's going to take you know, all your financial aspirations and your objectives and marry them up with, you know, what you need to do to get there. We're very focused on tax efficiency. One of our advisors is a tax lawyer. The other is a financial planner. I head up most of the investment management. So we've got a team and that looks at it from all of these different perspectives and comes together to deliver, you know, a unique solution for every specific individual.
And then if somebody wants to talk to you about that, is it Volarity, V-E-L-E-R-I-T-Y, wealth.com?
That's correct. Yeah. Yep. You can go to that website. There is an ability to just send you know, a message through the contact. So send a message. I'll get it directly, and I'll come back to you.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to do this on a weekly basis. And I do want to also let people know, if you have specific questions or things that you would like Zolfi to address, he is going to be sort of our finance guy here, and it's sort of bridging this world between, you know, institutional thinking and traditional finance with ours, which I think is an important bridge, because you can't have one, you know, you can't have one source of information here. You gotta kind of see things from different perspectives. Okay, Zolfi. So thanks again, and we'll catch you next week.
Sounds great. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement?
The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.